Evergreen Sermons Online in a Wednesday night message from August 29th, 2018, featuring Women's Ministry Director Amy Hawley.
Let's go ahead and get started. As many of you know, if you've known me at all, or if you've met me, just if you met me over the summer, you know that my husband Billy and I sent our youngest child off to college earlier this month. And so we have officially joined the Empty Nester Club. And of course, you know, that comes with a myriad of emotions and memories, as those of you who have been through it well know. And you know, we're very excited for her. We're really proud of her. We're looking forward to see what God does in her life. And we're a little curious about how her first semester of school and soccer and roommates will go. You know, even though we're confident in who she is, and of course we're even more confident in who God is. But I started thinking, as she was graduating from high school, I would notice on Facebook messages from parents and friends and family members to their graduating seniors with sentiments like, I know you're going to do big things, or go out and change the world. You're going to be great. So excited for you to do great things, you know. I know the future holds great things for this young lady, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's nothing wrong with those sentiments. In fact, you know, I've sent those to my kids in the past and all those things. But, you know, it's our way of encouraging them, acknowledging their accomplishment to that point, of just showing that we're proud of them. And I get that because, you know, I've done that too. But sometimes when I read them, I couldn't help but have the thought, but what if they don't? You know, as in, I know you're going to do big things, but what if they don't? What if they don't do big things? And is it still going to be okay? Can God still use them? I mean, what if God isn't calling them to be big and famous? You know, to write a bestseller or even lead thousands to Christ or, you know, be a famous singer or something like that. What if God is calling them to live a life of quiet obedience and faithfulness? I mean, what if God is planning to use them to change the world one act of anonymous boldness at a time? Will they still be doing great things? I mean, are we doing great things if that's us? So as I was thinking about this and doing things anonymously and all this, I studied and I read the story of a man who called up the local armory to get a report on the number and the status of weapons and vehicles. Well, a private answered the phone, and he said, we've got 3 Jeeps, 4 tanks, 500 rifles, and a ton of ammo. Oh, and we have 2 Cadillacs for the fat generals. There was silence, then this response. Private, do you know who I am? No. I'm General Weston. The private asked, General, do you know who I am? The general said, no. To which the private retorted, see you later, fatty. So, you know, there's something to be said for anonymity, but that really isn't the type of anonymity I'm talking about. All of this talk about being great and doing great things led me to think about greatness and what we mean by describing someone as great. And more importantly, it made me think about the way that God defines greatness. And this is what I'm going to talk about tonight. Back when I was reading all those Facebook messages to the graduates, and of course this type of sentiment, you know, isn't limited to a graduate. It can be a birthday, it can be a new job, it can be a move, whatever it is. But when I was reading them, I heard for the first time a song by Josh Wilson called Dream Small. And as I listened to the words, I thought, yes, this is what I was wondering. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to share some of the lyrics with you to kind of get an idea of what I'm talking about, where my thinking has been. It's a mama singing songs about the Lord. It's a daddy spending family time the world said he cannot afford. These simple moments change the world. It's a pastor at a tiny little church, 40 years of loving on the broken and the hurt. These simple moments change the world. It's visiting the widow down the street or dancing on a Friday with your friend with special needs. These simple moments change the world. Of course, there's nothing wrong with bigger dreams. Just don't miss the minutes on your way to bigger things, because these simple moments change the world. So dream small. Don't buy the lie you've got to do it all. Just let Jesus use you where you are, one day at a time. Live well, loving God and others as yourself. Find little ways where only you can help with His great love. a tiny rock can make a giant fall. So dream small. And so as I was thinking about it and as I heard that song, what I wanted to do is I wanted to express to my daughter, you know, don't worry so much about being great, or don't worry at all about becoming somebody. I wanted her to be faithful right where God placed her, you know, wherever that is. Let's pray. Father, I thank you so much for these that are here tonight and, Father, all over this campus. I thank you for faithful servants who come and serve and learn. And, Father, I just pray that you would just be with us tonight, that you would speak to each heart, that you will meet each person exactly where he or she is. I thank you for the time that I've had to spend in your word. And Father, I pray that you will use what I say to be honoring back to you. It's in your name I pray. Amen. You know, the Gospels of Matthew and Mark and Luke all record an incident that happened with the disciples. They were arguing about which of them would be the greatest in the kingdom. Now, this argument came after the transfiguration, and then after the scene after that where the disciples hadn't been able to cure a boy that had been brought to them. Remember this? And after Jesus had been teaching about all the suffering that was to come. So if you have your Bible, open it to the book of Matthew. We're going to look at Matthew 18, starting with verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child to himself and set him before them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." It's pretty obvious from the whole exchange that at that point the disciples weren't really completely fully grasping all that Jesus had been teaching. They'd heard the kingdom part maybe, but maybe not the suffering part, right? They were wanting to make sure that they would receive recognition and honor in Jesus' kingdom. But who does Jesus describe as the one who's the greatest in the kingdom? What are the requirements? You know, in verse 3, he tells them they must be converted. That word that's translated converted means to turn or to convert by switching direction or to make an about face. It can be literal, like a physical turning, or it can be figurative, changing direction in thinking and action. Then in verse 4, he says, "Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Now remember that children in the ancient world had no rights. They had no means of support apart from their family. They certainly didn't have any earthly status. And he tells them that they must be converted and become like children to attain greatness. The descriptions really kind of seem quite the opposite of what we naturally think. You know, when you hear about people who are great or you want them to do great things, you might say things like, "Yeah, reach for the stars," or "You just be yourself," or "Be you." You know, that's what the world tells us. We want our great people to make a splash, to be showy, to be on the cutting edge. Jesus simply says to be great, be converted, and be humble. Flip over in your Bible to Mark chapter 9. I want to look at this exchange again from that point of view. Let me find it. And we're going to start in verse 33. "And they came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he began to question them, 'What were you discussing on the way?' But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which one of them was the greatest. And sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, 'If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all.' And taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, 'Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me.'" So when you read it there, it kind of seems like maybe the disciples were, you know, caught in a discussion about which one of them was greatest. And maybe because they didn't respond, maybe they were a little bit embarrassed to be found out having the discussion. But what statement is added here that we've, in addition to what we've already seen in Matthew? If you look at verse 35, Jesus says, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." So to be great, first, I have to change my thinking. I have to convert. I have to humble myself, and I have to be a servant. What? Those who are great in the world are those who are served, right? Many times those that the world consider great have people waiting on their every whim and every desire to do anything that they need. This is upside down from what Jesus is teaching, which is precisely the point. God's view of greatness is completely the opposite of what the world sees as greatness. The world looks for fame or power or notoriety or prestige or money. God looks for humble servanthood with a heart turned in his direction. Now that we've seen Jesus' description of being great, I want to talk about an example of this type of kingdom greatness. You know, Jesus demonstrated it, but I also wanted to share another example of kingdom greatness. Now, this person may or may not be the first example that you think of when it comes to kingdom greatness. And probably at times during her life, others may not have seen it either. But I think that Ruth provides a standard for this type of kingdom greatness that Jesus described. You know, Ruth didn't lead an army. She didn't give great and compelling speeches that we know of. She never wrote a book that we are aware of, yet she became great in the kingdom. There are two books of the Bible named for women. One is Esther, who was a Jewish woman, and the other is Ruth. Ruth was a woman from Moab. The Moabites, if you remember, were descendants of Lot and his older daughter. This was after the destruction of Sodom and after their mother had been turned into a pillar of salt. His daughters decided they were going to get their father drunk in order to trick him into sleeping with them so that they would become pregnant. Both of the daughters do become pregnant, and the son of the oldest daughter was named Moab. That's the beginning of the Moabites. Now, the Moabites were on again, off again, enemies of Israel from the time the Israelites entered the promised land, and it went right on through the time of the judges. Sometimes they were fighting. Sometimes Israel would rebel against God and follow after the gods of Moab. Sometimes God would use the Moabites to punish Israel for their rebellion. At one point, they were in captivity to the Moabites for 18 years. The story of Ruth took place during the time of the judges. And at the time of the story, there was peace between Moab and Israel. As you remember, Ruth was the daughter-in-law of a Jewish woman named Naomi. Now, Naomi's husband, Elimelech, took her and her two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, from their hometown of Bethlehem to live in Moab during a famine that was in Judah. Eventually, Elimelech died, and Mahlon and Chilion, the two sons, who were both married to Moabite women, also died, leaving three widows. Now, Naomi decided to return to Bethlehem, destitute and alone, and she was hoping to find food there. Both of her daughters-in-law, however, want to stay with Naomi. Naomi convinced one daughter-in-law, Orpah, to stay in Moab with her mother, but Ruth insisted on staying with Naomi and going back to Bethlehem with her. If you haven't already, turn in your Bible to the book of Ruth, and we're going to start with chapter 1, beginning with verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that means Naomi, that she might return from the land of Moab. For she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you will go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Both Orpah and Ruth, at the beginning, made a commitment, right, to turn from their Moabite gods and to turn to the one true God because of the witness of Naomi. Now, Naomi never, especially at this point, sugarcoats the road ahead of them. She doesn't promise them it's going to be easy. She can't promise them any immediate physical blessings. I mean, she's a destitute widow hoping to find food. Both of the daughters-in-law have been with Naomi, and they've seen that her commitment to the Lord. But one daughter-in-law chooses to stay in Moab with her family and with her gods, the gods of Moab. But Ruth chooses the one true God. Ruth has resolved to follow Naomi, even to death. At that point, that's when Ruth was converted. She chose to follow after God. Remember what Jesus said about how to be great in Matthew 18:3, when the disciples were asking him, you know, who's the greatest in heaven? He said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." So Ruth completed step one in Jesus' explanation of greatness. She was converted. She began following the one true God. The next step that Jesus described was humility. How did Ruth demonstrate humility? Let's look at her character in chapter 2. We're going to see that Ruth was humble. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. "Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor.' And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, 'May the Lord be with you.' And they said, 'May the Lord bless you.' Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?' And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, 'She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while." So Ruth and Naomi arrive in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now Naomi, verse 1, knows something that Ruth doesn't know. Naomi's husband has a rich relative in Bethlehem named Boaz. All Ruth knows is that she needs to do something so that the two women can eat. So she asks for permission to go glean for the scraps of grain that would be left in the field during the harvest. The worst way that Ruth humbled herself is she put herself under the authority of Naomi. She did it by asking permission to go glean. You know, great people are great beneath God and great beneath men. In other words, they understand and are willing to submit to authority. Ruth is faithful right where she is. You know, Jesus is an example of putting oneself under authority. Think about it. Jesus, the Word who became flesh, was with God and was God from the beginning. He was there at creation. All things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being. Yet, he submitted himself to earthly authority. He started with his parents. In Luke 2, we're told of a visit by Jesus and Mary and Joseph. We're going to flip back to Luke a couple of times, but don't lose your place in Ruth because we're coming back. But Luke chapter 2, starting in verse 41. "And his parents," that means Jesus' parents, "used to go to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. And as they were returning, after spending the full number of days, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, and his parents were unaware of it, but supposed him to be in the caravan and went a day's journey, and they began looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem looking for him. And it came about that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." And he said to them, "Why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house?" And they didn't understand the statement which he had made to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth. And he continued in subjection to them. And his mother treasured all these things in her heart. Okay, here he is. He's 12 years old. They're in Jerusalem. He stays behind in the temple and they leave. What's he doing? He's talking to the teachers. Not only talking, he's amazing them. He's wowing them, right, with his understanding and his knowledge of the truth. Yet, even after that, he still submitted to his parents. And he went with them to Nazareth, and he was under their authority. So not only does Ruth put herself under the authority of Naomi, which Jesus also demonstrated, which demonstrates humility, but she's polite about it. Look back at Ruth, verse 2, chapter 2. She says, "Please, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain." So the first characteristic that demonstrates Ruth's humility is her politeness, but more importantly is putting herself under the authority of another person. So let's look at another characteristic that demonstrates her humility. She's also honest before God. Look back again at verse 2. It says, "Please let me go into the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." Now, the rule was that a Jew had to leave his gleanings for the poor. They couldn't go up and pick up every single bit of grain. Ruth was a Moabite. So the owner of the field really wasn't obligated to help her so much, and she recognized that she's owed nothing. Remember? She's looking for favor. She knows that she has nothing to offer, that she's not entitled to anything, but she humbled herself by becoming a gleaner. This is a really low type of job. She's in the back of the line. The gleaners followed after the reapers and gathered what had been dropped. Kind of the leftovers, basically. This was even below the household servants, but she willingly went and gleaned to provide for her mother-in-law. Remember what Jesus said in Luke 14, 7 through 11. I cheated because I had my sort of marked. But this is what he said. "And Jesus began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking up places of honor at the table, saying to them, 'When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both shall come and say to you, "Give place to this man." And then in disgrace, you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you're invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself shall be exalted." Jesus is giving him some practical advice, right? How to not make a fool out of yourself by thinking you're the most important person in a room when you get invited somewhere. But in that lesson, he's again teaching about kingdom greatness. We're not to exalt ourselves. We're to leave that to God. You know, Jesus demonstrated that principle with his life. Philippians 2:5 says, "Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." Where did Ruth start? She started at the bottom. She started as a gleaner. Not only was she a gleaner, she was a foreign, widowed, destitute gleaner. She didn't come thinking that God owed her something because now she was actually following him. She didn't say, "God, I left everything I've known to follow, so now you owe me some favor and some recognition." She didn't come into this whole situation thinking, "If I just put in the hard work and bide my time, one day I'm going to get some fame and recognition." She wasn't doing anything in order to get anything but favor from God. She wasn't saying, "Wow, one day they're going to write about me in this holy book." That's not what her thought was. She was just honoring God where she was. She was just getting food for herself and her mother-in-law. She had humbled herself, submitted to the authority of Naomi, and she recognized her position before God. She was also a servant. Ruth demonstrated that she was a servant through her work ethic. She was a hard worker. Look back at Ruth chapter 2, verses 5 through 7. Says, then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, please, there's that politeness again, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. She'd been working all day, right? She'd been gleaning and picking up and bending over and doing those things. Boaz noticed Ruth, and he asked the reapers about her. And the head reaper tells her, you know, who she is and that she'd been the one, she'd been working all day long. Do you think it was a coincidence that Ruth took that one break right at the time when Boaz came to the field? I mean, was it a coincidence that Ruth was gleaning in the field of Boaz in the first place? And there were probably lots of fields, but she was in the field of Boaz. Of course not. This was directed by the Holy Spirit. God had a plan for Ruth and Boaz. They just didn't know it yet. Ruth was just being faithful where she was. Ruth had a good reputation that got reported to Boaz. She worked hard. They said all morning till just now. Ruth bloomed where she was planted. She did her lowly job heartily. Colossians 3:23 says, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. How are you seen by others? How are you perceived at work? How are you perceived at church? Is it as a hardworking bondservant? Do you have a good reputation for being trustworthy and reliable and responsible? Ruth honored God with her willingness to work hard, even though there was nothing glamorous about the work she was doing. Ruth demonstrated with her example of what, demonstrated the example of what Jesus described to his disciples when they wanted to be great. Ruth was converted, Ruth was humble, and Ruth was a servant. These are the characteristics that lead to greatness in the kingdom. I read a quote that was attributed to Matthew Henry, although I couldn't find the original quote to confirm the source, but either way, it's a great quote. Greatness is to a Christian like a shadow is to a person. The more you pursue greatness, the more it stays in front of you. But the more you try to run from it, as by being humble, the more greatness like a shadow follows at your heels. As a Christian, our goal is not to attain our own greatness. It's to follow Christ in obedience. It's a continued walk toward Christ-likeness. We're not to exalt ourselves. That's God's place. Let's look again at Ruth. We've seen her conversion with her decision to go with Naomi and follow Naomi's God, turning away from the gods that were worshipped by the Moabites, returning to Bethlehem without a promise of anything, materially speaking. We've seen her humility as she put herself under the authority of her mother-in-law, and we've seen her servant heart as she gleaned in the field to provide for Naomi. So what was the result of all of this? Remember, Ruth didn't know God's plan of placing her in the field of Boaz. She most likely didn't even know the kinsman redeemer rule, since she was raised in Moab rather than Judah. But God did. Don't you just love that phrase? But God. So Ruth is going about the business of gleaning when she meets Boaz. Remember, he's already asked the reapers about who she is, and he's heard of her good reputation. So look at verses 8 and 9 of Ruth chapter 2. Then Boaz said to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw. So Boaz has just elevated her from gleaner to a level with his servants, right? We might think that Ruth just got lucky. You know, she was at the right place, the right time. She happened to be there. Here comes Boaz. He noticed her. But there's more to it than that. She was trusting God and honoring him with her humble service to Naomi. She was being faithful to the promise that she made to Naomi and to God when she left Moab. God always interrupts great men and women in the midst of faithfulness. So was Ruth lucky? Not exactly. She was in the right place at the right time, but it was because of God's providence and her own faithfulness that she was there. Let's look at exaltation to greatness. God is the one who should be doing the exalting in the life of a believer. So if you look back at 14:11 of Luke, it says, "For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself shall be exalted." So we have a choice. Do you want to be humbled or do you want to get humbled? We can choose. I think it'd be better if we are exalted by God and we humble ourselves rather than being humbled. Ruth hadn't exalted herself, and we see God through Boaz elevating her to a higher position. And then Boaz continues to bless Ruth. Look down at verses 14 through 16. "And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. And also, you shall purposely pull out some grain for her from the bundles and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her.'" So we've already seen him start to elevate her position, but now he's offering protection for her, right? If she works only in his field, he offers water and food with the reapers. He doesn't say, "Go off by yourself, you foreign, destitute widow woman." No, she's right there with them, and he's serving her from his food. But there's even more greater blessings to come. Look at verse 17. "So she gleaned in the field until evening." See, she kept on working even though she got elevated. She didn't go, "Oh, I've made it. I got my grain. I'm good to go." She kept on working. "Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. Her mother-in-law then said to her, 'Where did you glean today, and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed.' So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, 'The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz.'" All right, I love this part. This is getting better and better. When Ruth gets back home, she's got more than enough grain. Remember, she's already eaten and she was satisfied and she had leftovers. And it says that she brought an ephah. Ephah was a big basket that was equal to a little bit more than a bushel. So here she is lugging this thing home. I don't know how she got it home, if somebody helped her or what, but it's awfully a big basket. So Naomi says, "You know, how'd your day go? Where'd you glean today? What happened?" But she noticed all the stuff, didn't she? She noticed the provision, and she said, "May he who took notice of you be blessed." The first exaltation of Ruth was that she was noticed. If you're faithfully living a life of obedience, whether you know it or not, whether you feel it or not, you're being noticed. Now, other people may or may not notice you, but God, there's that phrase again, but God does. He notices. Can you imagine the big smile that must have come over Naomi's face when Ruth told her that she had gleaned in the field of Boaz? I mean, I imagine her heart probably started beating a little quicker when she heard all that Boaz had done for her. Naomi knew the law about the kinsman redeemer. A kinsman redeemer was God's way of keeping you from poverty. So if you were a widow or destitute, lost all your money or land, or if you'd become a slave, God fixed it for you by having your nearest relative come to you and take you as his wife. So not only would you become the wife of your husband's brother or cousin or nearest closest relative, but the kinsman redeemer would also raise up children that belonged to your first husband so that you had someone to take care of you and to continue the name of your first husband. So I'm sure that when Naomi heard about Boaz, she got really excited. You know, she sees what's coming. She's starting to put the pieces together. She's getting a glimpse of what God might be doing for them. There are three requirements for a kinsman redeemer. First one is he had to be family. The second one was he had to be wealthy enough to be able to do it. And the third one was he had to be willing to do it. He had to be willing to be the redeemer. There's so much great theology in the book of Ruth that many people refer to it as the Gospel of Ruth. And I don't have time to go into that, but if you're interested, there is a great Bible study on Right Now Media by Tommy Nelson on the Book of Ruth. I think there's about 10 sessions, and it is worth your time. It is excellent. But I do want to point out just one similarity between Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, and our kinsman redeemer, Jesus. Remember rule number one, or requirement number one? He had to be family. Jesus came to earth in human form. He became like us, just like family. He was a part of the family of humanity. Number two, he had to be wealthy enough to do it. Was Jesus wealthy enough to redeem us? Yes, because the price to redeem us was his sinless life. The sacrifice for our sin had to be perfection. And Jesus was and is perfect. Therefore, he had the means necessary to pay the price. And then number three, he had to be willing. Jesus, remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, said, "Father, if thou art willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but thine be done." Jesus was willing to be our Redeemer. He met all the requirements necessary. And let's go back to Boaz. We know he was in the family of Naomi's husband Elimelech, and we know that he was wealthy based on verse 1 of chapter 2. But let's see if he was willing. In chapter 3, we see Naomi instructing Ruth to prepare to go to Boaz. Now, if you read it, it seems odd to our Western ears, the steps that she had her take. But essentially, Ruth's actions are asking Boaz to do his biblical duty. She's asking in obedience to Naomi and in faith and trust to become the redeemer. She comes to him in an honoring way, even though when you read it, it seems like a kind of a weird exchange between Boaz and Ruth, but it was done in purity and propriety. So we have Boaz, and he's sleeping with his grain, which is not uncommon. He's sleeping with it to protect it from potential thieves and anything that could, any harm that might come to it. And Ruth comes and waits for him to wake up. And when he does, he basically asks, who's there? So look at chapter 3, starting with verse 9. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." All right, so she's asking for his protection. Put your covering over me, your covering of protection over him, and for him to become her kinsman redeemer. Ruth is quiet, and she's polite, but she's bold. I mean, how does Boaz respond? He asks for God's blessing on her, and he praises her for her actions. Verse 10, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have shown me your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether rich or poor." The first kindness was the kindness that she showed to her mother-in-law. But here, he's recognizing a kindness that's been shown to him. Ruth was a young woman. Boaz was an older man. But rather than going for some young guy, some young dude, hottie, whatever, poor, rich, it didn't matter, she put Naomi's need and her own obedience ahead of herself. She went for the kinsman redeemer, which was God's plan. Not only does Boaz offer a blessing for her, but he also honors her by calling her what? A woman of excellence. So far we've seen that Boaz is family, requirement number one, that he's wealthy, requirement number two, and then we see in verse 11 that he's also willing. I'm willing to do what you're asking me. Boaz meets the requirement to become the kinsman redeemer for Ruth. Oh, but there's a problem. Look at verses 12 through 14. You can find it. We can write a chapter. "And now it is true, I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. So what's the problem? The problem is there's a relative that's more closely related to Elimelech than Boaz. And because Boaz is a godly man, I mean, he could have just gone, they could have made this arrangement and gone on and everything would have been hunky-dory, but he's a godly man and he wants to do things God's way. And so what he does is he does the right thing by going to the closer relative and let him know of his obligation and his right to Ruth and Naomi and to give the closer relative an opportunity to become the redeemer. So look at chapter 4, starting with verse 1. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. And he said to the closest relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "Oh yeah, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance." And the closest relative said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it." Okay, so he talks to the closer relative, right? And he gets all these people. Why does he have all the people around? To be witnesses, right? To see what's going on, to watch the whole thing. And he talks to the closer relative, and he finds out, first the guy's, "Yeah, okay, I'll redeem that land. Oh yeah, by the way, there's a widow and her mother-in-law." And he's like, "Oh, wait a minute, I can't do that. I don't want to jeopardize my inheritance." So what happened? He met the first requirement, he was related. He might have had some money, but he didn't meet the third one, which was he had to be willing. So he doesn't meet him. So Boaz then makes that transaction official in front of all the elders and all the people in verses 9 and 10. So it's a legal transaction. Hold on, sorry. All right. So then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You were witnesses today." So he makes it official, right? He's got witnesses. It's a legal transaction. He's going to redeem the land. And he's going to take Ruth to be his wife. Now we see the blessings. Now the blessings start coming. Look at verse 11. "And the people who were in the court and the elders said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord shall give you by this young woman.'" So what are the blessings? "Be as fruitful as Rachel and Leah." What's he talking about? What are they talking about? Well, you know Rachel and Leah. Remember, they were the two wives of Jacob or Israel. And they, along with their maids, were the mothers of all the men who were the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel. So they're blessing them to have a big family and to be successful. And then they talk about Perez. Who's Perez? Well, he was one of the twins of Judah and his daughter-in-law, Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar. And remember when Tamar was in labor, giving birth to these twins, one of the babies stuck his hand out and the midwife tied a ribbon to it. And then he pulled the hand back in. The other twin actually came out first. But because Perez broke through first, which his name meant broke through, he was then the firstborn. Perez was the offspring also of a union between a widow and his husband Ken, just like this union's going to be, even though Tamar had to resort to trickery for that to happen. Now, Tamar was also a non-Israelite, like Ruth. So it's not surprising that Perez comes to the mind of the people. Now, Perez became the main ancestors of the Ephrathites and the Bethlehemites. Even though Perez was born under some scandalous circumstances, his offspring became one of the most important clans in Judah. and he was an ancestor of Boaz. Perez had an unbroken line of male descendants extending over several generations. So these blessings were for the union of Ruth and Boaz to produce children who would continue that unbroken line of blessing, that they would have a family comparable to the family of Jacob. May you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. So let's go on and see some more blessings starting in verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." So here they come. The blessings just keep on coming. In verse 14, they're blessing God. They're recognizing that he's the one behind it all. These were not just coincidences that got them to this point. They recognize he's the one that worked out all the details. He's the one that orchestrated the whole circumstance. And in verse 15, Naomi, remember the mother-in-law, who had lost everything back in Moab. In fact, when she came back from Moab, she said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because I'm bitter, because God has gone against me." So they're blessing her as well. She's blessed with joy and this birth of this son. The final section that we're going to read tonight in Ruth is verses 16 and 17. And it says, "Then Naomi," remember the mother-in-law, "took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David." So we see here from that bitterness that Naomi had experienced, we see joy restored to her by the birth of this son. And they also gave him a name. His name was Obed. Obed means servant of God, which reflects the lives of both of his parents. And now we come to the greatness part. Ruth was described by Boaz in chapter 2, verse 11, as a woman of excellence. Remember? She had that reputation in all of Bethlehem. Everyone who knew her, or even knew of her, knew that she was a woman of excellence. She had been elevated to that reputation, that position, by her faithfulness and her humility. She has her story recorded in the Bible, right? She's become famous to generations from that time all the way down to our generation, and it's going to go past our generation as well. Her son was the grandfather of Israel's greatest king, King David. But most of all, Ruth is listed in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. This widowed Moabite woman who decided to follow the God that Naomi followed and who was faithful and humble in her service was elevated all the way to be a direct descendant of Jesus. Talk about greatness. But actually, Ruth was great back when she decided to follow God and was faithfully gleaning in the field, wasn't she? She was converted, she was humble, and she was a servant. Claude Lombard said, "The General Conference presidency is not more important in God's eyes than the servant ministry of the little old sister who visits her neighbor to give her a Bible study in her home or take her a loaf of freshly baked bread to show God's love in her time of need." We look at the outward a lot of times to measure greatness, but the Lord looks at the heart. Fame and fortune and power really, really don't equal greatness. Our ambition should not be to make a name for ourselves, but to make Jesus famous. As we're faithful where we are, God will be responsible for placing us where he wants us. Some of us will be called to positions to be seen and known by many people or do great big things that are recognizable. Others of us are going to be called to be faithful and anonymously live a life of obedience. In either case, God elevates us to greatness when we are converted and humble and are servant of all.